Genesis chapter 6. What we're going to be looking at this morning is the flood. And as we get into this, let's look at the reason that the flood came. We're going to take it up from verse 9 in chapter 6. This is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. And Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth." So we see the reason behind it. The earth was corrupt. In reality, it was man that was corrupt, isn't it? Man was wicked upon the earth, and so judgment was coming, and mankind now has reaped what they had sown. You know, it says in Galatians chapter 6, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For if he sows to the flesh, he will of the flesh reap corruption. But if he sows to the Spirit, he will of the Spirit reap everlasting life." So we basically have one of two roads we can go down. We can choose to live after the flesh, and you can be guaranteed that one who does that is going to reap corruption or destruction. Or we can follow after the Spirit, and if we follow after God's leading in our life, we will reap blessings and everlasting life. Well, here we find that those in Noah's day lived for themselves. They act wickedly, and so judgment was coming. But as it says of Noah, he walked with God, and so he found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Again, we go to the book of Hebrews, that chapter that deals with the hall of faith, and we find in Hebrews 11, verse 7, "By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith." So Noah walked with God, he believed in him, he trusted in him, and as it says here, being divinely warned of things not yet seen. Well, it sure had never flooded the earth before, but it's a good possibility that it had never even rained upon the earth. So Noah, just being obedient to God, following after him, built the ark and was saved, he and his household. Well, let's read on from verse 14. God said to him, "Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above, and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. And behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh you shall bring two of every sort into the ark, to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, of animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind. Two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. And you shall take for yourself of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and for them." Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him. So he did. So Noah made the ark. And then he would take a pair of each animals and bring them into the ark along with food, and they would be preserved in that ark for a little over a year until the floodwaters came, destroyed man and beast on the earth, and then subsided for Noah and his crew to get off. Back in verse 14, it says, "Make yourself an ark of gopher wood." It's interesting. I like digging in sometimes to the original languages, because this Hebrew word for ark here is only used one other place in the Bible. Now, it's used a number of times in these three or four chapters, but it's only used one other place in the Old Testament, and it speaks of another person who was saved in an ark. You know where that's at? Exodus chapter 2. It says, "But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank." You know who that is? Moses, right. She took a little wicker basket, same word here that's used for ark. She took a little basket, covered it in pitch, so it'd be like a tarry substance to keep the water out, and then put him in the Nile so that Pharaoh's daughter could find him and protect him. And so in like manner here, Noah was also to take this ark and cover it with pitch. And it was most likely some kind of resin substance. But again, the interesting thing is it's not the same word for pitch. In fact, the word is the word we get the word atonement for in the Old Testament. It's the Hebrew word kofar. And so just like this kind of resiny substance kept out the floodwaters of judgment, so in like manner, when the people in the Old Testament would offer their sacrifices, it would keep them from God's judgment. In like manner, Jesus, when he died on the cross, he made atonement for our soul. So it's a neat picture you have in there of that. Well, let's look at the ark. Verse 15, it speaks of it being 300 cubits. A cubit is the distance from your elbow to the tip of your finger. So roughly speaking, it's about 18 inches. So the ark was to be about 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet tall. The interesting thing about the ark, it was a very seaworthy vessel. The design was ideal for stability and capacity. It would have been practically impossible to capsize. You'd be able to fit 522 livestock railroad cars inside of the ark. That means that 240 sheep per livestock car, you could fit 125,000 sheep upon the ark. Now, there's no more than 25,000 species of animals that are known today, either alive or extinct. So you could have easily, or Noah could have easily, fit all of the animals on the ark with really about half the ark to spare, because the average size of most animals is going to be smaller than that of a sheep. Now, some people ask, well, how did he get the dinosaurs on there, and how did he get the elephants on there? Well, most likely, he probably took babies on there, so they wouldn't take up quite as much room. And it's an interesting thing about animals, a number of them will actually hibernate in storm-like conditions. So it's possible that a number of them slept for that year-long period, and at the end of it, they went out of the ark, and of course, Noah had a lot of food on the ark. Remember that they were not meat eaters at that time, so they were not going to tear each other apart. They would probably just eat the vegetation that Noah brought on the ark. And another interesting thing to notice is Noah didn't have to go search for all of these animals. Remember it said there in verse 20, that two of every kind will come to you. Some way, somehow they came. Probably God spoke to them, moved them to come. It's interesting how animals are, how birds know to migrate to the south when winter comes. We have some of those even in our own community that we refer to as snowbirds that come to the south. And God easily could have, you know, put it upon their heart to come into the ark. And so they came into the ark, and we read on in chapter 7 here. It says, then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I've seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. So God bids Noah to come. You know, God is bidding people to come today, to come and be safe in the protection that he has to offer from judgment. Jesus said, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. It's interesting, in Noah's day, only Noah, his sons, and their wives came to God to be spared. There was a whole world full of people that perished in the flood. And it's interesting today that there's so many people who do not respond to the Lord's invitation to come and to be saved. Noah goes on to say in verse 2, you shall take with you seven each of every clean animal, a male and his female, two each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female. So they're to take two of every kind, but when it comes to the clean animals, they're to take seven. Now, how did Noah know what was clean? How did he know what God referred to as a clean animal and an unclean animal? The law of Moses wouldn't come for hundreds of years. You see, in reality, Noah knew what was acceptable and not acceptable to God. Just like Cain and Abel knew what was acceptable and not acceptable. When they brought their offerings there, God told Cain that if you do well, will it not go well with you? And so here, Noah knew what was clean and what was unclean. Why did he take seven? Well, we're going to find in the next chapter that when he gets off of the ark, he's going to offer one of each kind as a burnt offering to the Lord. And we're also going to find from the chapter following that man became meat eaters when they came off the ark. So maybe it was food until there was, you know, enough food to grow on the earth. Well, we go on to read in verse 3. Also seven each of birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of the earth. For after seven more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made. And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the floodwaters were on the earth. So Noah with his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. of clean animals, of animals that are unclean, of birds, and of everything that creeps on the earth. Two by two, they went into the ark to Noah, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were on the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep were broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. And we need to realize that it was not just rain that came upon the earth, but the fountains of the great deep, these subterranean caverns that must have had tons of water in them, came erupting up upon the earth. And of course, that water canopy that enshrouded the earth now is being broken up and falling upon the earth. Verse 12, and the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On the very same day, Noah and Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They and every beast after its kind and cattle after their kind, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind and every bird after its kind, every bird of every sort. And they went into the ark to Noah, two by two of all flesh, in which is the breath of life. So those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. Did you realize that there's only one door on the side of the ark? There's only one way to get in that safe place. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Remember Jesus said in John chapter 10, I am the door. He also said in John 14, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. You see, the only way these people would be safe from the floodwaters is if they went through this one door, God's one provision for them to be saved. It says in Psalm 91, verse 1, he who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in him I will trust. Did you also notice that it says the Lord shut him in? You see, God's the one who closed him in. Boy, you talk about security. You talk about being safe there. Goes on to say in verse 17, now the flood was on the earth 40 days. The waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. That would be 22.5 feet above the highest mountain. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was on the dry land died. So he destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping thing and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. So it not only rained for 40 days, but those waters stayed on the earth for 150 days. It says that all the high hills under heaven were covered. Now to me, that sounds like a global flood. It doesn't sound like a regional flood. I mean, if it had been just a regional flood, there would have been no point for the ark. Noah could have just moved to higher ground and taken the animals with him. You know, there's some interesting facts. Most of our mountain ranges are made up of massive flood-deposited layers. Fossils abound on the tops of the highest mountains. Take Mount Everest for an example. The top 3,000 feet of Mount Everest is made up of sedimentary rock packed with seashells and other ocean-dwelling animals. Even the summit of Mount Ararat was at one time underwater, evidenced by the marine fossils that have been found there. Now, most likely, there weren't the high mountains that we have today. Maybe they were a lot lower, and possibly the flood made those mountain ranges go higher, and I'll explain to you why I think that. In Psalm 104, verses 6 through 8, it says, the waters were standing above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the sound of your thunder they hurried away. The mountains rose. The valley sank down to the place which you established for them. Now, 8 out of 14 translations will translate this verse like that, that the mountains rose and the valley sank down. And think about it. You've got water covering the earth, and it's 22.5 feet higher than the highest mountain. And when that stuff starts going down and receding into the earth again, these subterranean caverns, you can imagine the erosion that would take place and how the water would seep into the canyons and the swirling effect and how the topography of the whole earth would be changed. And possibly what this is saying here is that the waters that went down into these canyons pushed in and made the ocean basins, the valleys sinking down. And in like manner, when that took place, it would push up on other portions of the earth, pushing up the mountain ranges, possibly to higher distances. It's another interesting fact that there's enough water in the oceans right now to cover the earth 8,000 feet deep if the surface of the earth were smooth. We find that most of our mountain ranges have fossils, marine-type fossils on top of them. Let's talk about fossils for just a minute. To become fossilized, a plant or animal must usually have hard parts, such as bone, shell, or wood. It also must be buried quickly to prevent decay, and that's a big part right there. Buried quickly to prevent decay, and it must be undisturbed through the long process. Now, when you find a fossilized fish with its mouth open wide, frozen, in the act of swallowing another fish, you realize this didn't happen over millions of years. It was instantly entombed in tons of mud. Now, another thing to take note of is that the greenhouse effect would be gone. Remember that you have the water canopy surrounding the earth, and so it was a tropical climate, most likely, throughout the whole earth. But when that water canopy dissipated, we would then have our polar caps, where the cold would be at both ends of the earth, the North Pole and the South Pole. Therefore, we would have the snow and the massive ice sheets. And of course, we have some proof, too, that it was tropical up in that area. Frozen fruit trees have been found with fruit still on them up at the Arctic Circle. Redwood forests are found buried under massive ice deposits at the South Polar region. And another interesting thing, thousands of frozen mammoths have been found up around the Arctic Circle. In fact, many of them standing upright and also with food still in their stomach that hasn't been digested. Now, these apparently died of suffocation because there was no water inside of their lungs. Small ice crystals were in their blood, and also it is estimated that they died in probably a period of about 5 hours. Otherwise, that food would have just digested or they would have rotted out. Now, a possible explanation for that is they were up there in that region, being tropical at the end of the poles, and then when the flood came and, of course, the coldness started at the poles, it was snowfall, and they just got stuck in a snowdrift, and rapidly as it came upon them, concealed them or entombed them in ice. Now, it's another interesting thing that throughout the world there are a lot of flood stories. In fact, there's almost 300 flood stories from various cultures. You have to remember again that when the flood came, it was only Noah and his sons that began the earth. So after the Tower of Babel, when man was dispersed throughout the earth, there was the story from Noah and his sons of what actually took place. And of course, it got probably changed a little bit as time went on in various cultures. But here, the legend that comes from Hawaii, it says, long after the death of Kunihunahuna, the first man, the world became a wicked, terrible place to live. There was one good man left. His name was Nuyu. That's interesting, isn't it? Kind of like Noah. His name was Nuyu. And he made a great canoe with a house on it and filled it with animals. The waters came up over all the earth and killed all the people. Only Nuyu and his family were saved. Here's one from China. Fuhi, his wife, three sons and three daughters, escaped a great flood. He and his family were the only people alive on earth. After the great flood, they repopulated the world. Here's one from Mexico. The first world that lasted 1,716 years was destroyed by a great flood. Now, I find that date interesting because it was 1,656 years after Adam that the flood came on the earth. So that's only off 60 years. So after this time, the earth was destroyed by a great flood that covered the highest mountains. The few that survived built a great tower to protect them from another flood. And we're going to talk about a great tower next week when we speak of the Tower of Babel. So interesting stories that have gone, again, almost 300 of them that are in various cultures of the earth that are speaking of some kind of global flood. Now, I think personally that it's just a testimony to the fact that there was a flood that affected the entire earth, and people still speak about it to this day in various cultures. Now, on top of that, the prophet Isaiah, the prophet Ezekiel, both mention Noah. You know, we look to the Bible and we find credence for this story of Noah and the flood. Some people think it's just a Sunday school story that little kids learn about and you read in the little children's Bible to your kids when they're going to bed at night. But in reality, the men of the Bible believed the story. Isaiah believed it. Ezekiel mentioned Noah. Peter, in both of his letters, mentions not only Noah, but the ark and the flood. And of course, Jesus said, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will also be in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came. Hey, if Jesus believed it, that's good enough for me. Well, let's move on to chapter 8. It says, then God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. God remembered Noah. I wonder what it was like for Noah to be on the ark as the months passed by. Remember, again, he was on it for over a year, 53 weeks. And as he would look out the window of the ark and just see water in every direction and possibly bodies floating on the top of that water, I wonder if he ever wondered what was going to happen to him. You know, sometimes when the storm waters of life crash around us, sometimes we wonder, hey, does God still see me? Does he still care? You can better believe that God still cares about you. It says in Hebrews chapter 13, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. Jesus said, lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. God, through the prophet Isaiah, said, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, nor shall the flame scorch you, for I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel. It says here in kind of a, I guess you would say, an anthropomorphic way, God remembered Noah. God hadn't forgotten. It was just time now for the waters to recede from the earth. And so this is when it began to happen. Verse 2, the fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were also stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters receded continually from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the waters decreased. Now imagine the erosion that would take place. You've got a global flood that's 22 and a half feet above the highest mountain, however high that was back then. Now you have all of these waters receding back into these subterranean caverns. Think what the runoff would look like. I know what it's like when I wash my car. It doesn't happen very often, but when that water runs down the end of the driveway into the dirt, it begins to erode it. And I'm going to suggest to you that the great flood caused many of the badlands or the terrain that we see today, including the Grand Canyon. And the reason I'm going to say this is because we have actually an example that has taken place in our lifetime of a catastrophe that has made something very similar to the Grand Canyon, and that is the catastrophe that took place at Mount St. Helens in 1980. Mount St. Helens in Washington State erupted, and it caused great catastrophe upon the earth at that time. The north slope slid down the side of the mountain. While the north slope slid down the mountain, the volcano was uncorked, releasing the ash and steam. The summit lost 1,300 feet of elevation. A half cubic mile slid off the summit. In the initial eruption, it was the equivalent to 20 million tons of TNT blast energy. And I want you to notice, that's not blasting straight up. It's blasting to the side. It's blasting northward. 550 degrees were inside this cloud, and it was moving at a rate of 200 miles per hour. It leveled 150 square miles of trees in just 6 minutes. In the full eruption, of course, the eruption lasted 9 hours that day. It was equivalent to 400 million tons of TNT blast energy. That's the equivalent of 30,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs. Seeing that it lasted 9 hours, that would be the equivalent of one atomic bomb per second. That's the type of energy that was coming out of Mount St. Helens. Now, the interesting thing, the landslide buried the river to Spirit Lake, which was just north of Mount St. Helens, to an average depth of 100 feet. So this is the mud and ash that you have laid down upon the river that was coming in to Spirit Lake. It also buried most other drainages that would drain the liquid, the water, off of Mount St. Helens. 22 months later, another eruption created another mud flow that opened the drainages. So during this nearly two-year period, water is building up on top of Mount St. Helens, and then another eruption takes place. And literally what happened, a sheet of ice was dislodged, and it came down, and it breached the dam that was keeping that water up there. It carved at least three canyons 100 feet deep, and it happened in less than 9 hours. Now, when water starts to erode over the top of a dam, it happens very quickly, cutting it away until you have a canyon formed. And this canyon here that was a result of the eruption nearly 2 years later that came from Mount St. Helens created this canyon 1,000 feet wide and 140 feet deep. Now, you have to remember one thing. The material that this canyon was made out of, or that this bore through, was the same material that was laid down from the initial eruption that happened some 2 years earlier. You follow me on that? So the interesting thing about it, as they look at the side of the canyon wall, they see these thousands of layers of sediment that are there. Now, some people, some geologists, would look at this and say this took thousands of years, millions of years maybe, for these sediments to lay down, where in actuality it just took minutes to lay down at the initial eruption some 2 years earlier. Now, there's a little river that flows through the center of this canyon, but I'm going to suggest to you, as a fact, that this river did not create the canyon, because we know it was this massive landslide that came down and this large mass of water that came through that created the canyon. And now there's just a little drainage river that heads out towards the Pacific Ocean that flows through it. I'm also going to suggest to you that this little river didn't create this canyon, even though the Grand Canyon is 40 times bigger than the one we see at Mount St. Helens. Even though the textbooks tell us that this river did create the Grand Canyon over millions of years. Now think about it. Think if there was a dam that blocked up the Colorado River. Think of a large basin of water that would be just north of the Colorado River. And think if that thing got breached, what it would do as far as erosion goes to that area. I think it could create something like the Grand Canyon. Another interesting thing to note is at the entrance to the canyon where the river comes in, it's 2,800 feet in elevation. As it flows through, it drops down to 1,800 feet. Yet the rim of the canyon is almost 7,000 feet high. Now, it's a 4,000 foot climb for this river. If this river actually cut the Grand Canyon, it would have had to flow uphill 4,000 feet to cut that canyon away. And the last time I looked, rivers don't flow uphill. Again, I think it could have been a large body of water that was just north of the area. The dam was breached and then cut through it and carved in the Grand Canyon. Interesting photo here. The top ridge that goes over the canyon is covered in snow. You can kind of see how that could have been a dam holding a body of water just north of there, and then that breached. And again, I'm going to suggest that this was created some way, somehow, through the flood. Fascinating, isn't it? Well, verse 4 of chapter 8 says, "Then the ark rested in the seventh month, the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat." Now, it's interesting here how we're given the exact day, the exact month. The reason it's interesting, I think, is because you possibly can find other things that happened on this same day during the year. Now, you remember the time of the Passover. God said he was going to change their calendar because it was such a significant event, because he was going to rescue his people out of Egypt. He said, this is going to be your first month, and you're going to celebrate on the 14th day of this month, the Passover feast. Now, there were some who make the connection that this month here, the seventh month, became the first month at the time of the Passover. And so the interesting thing about this, the interesting thing about Noah's Ark resting on the 17th day, is that Passover would be celebrated on the 14th day. Passover is the day that Jesus was crucified. Jesus rose from the dead 3 days later. So Jesus rose from the dead on the 17th day, the same day that Noah's Ark rested on the mountains of Ararat. What's the significance? I'd say new beginning. New beginning. Now, Mount Ararat, eastern Turkey, is where it's located. The top of the mountain is always covered with snow. There are some who feel that Noah's Ark is up there. Here is a shot from a satellite. But Noah's Ark is believed to be in the area indicated by the circle. Now, I've read half a dozen reports of guys who have gone up there searching for the Ark, and some people that said, we found it and everything, and yet there's really no concrete evidence that I've seen. You know, a good picture of the full-size Ark, or, you know, a hunk of wood taken from it and bringing it down. So it's hard to say, you know, dogmatically it's up there. But it's hard to say it's not up there either. The thing's covered in snow, and it's, you know, just not that easy to get an expedition team into eastern Turkey these days. So it's hard to go up and really see for sure if it's there. Some people would say, oh, if they found Noah's Ark, boy, think of all the people who would then believe the Bible. I don't think so. Unfortunately, I don't think so. Remember Jesus, as he was talking about the rich man and Lazarus. Both of them died. They both went to Hades. And the rich man was in there talking with Abraham. He saw Abraham across this great gulf. And he asked for Lazarus to go back at least and tell his brothers, so that his brothers wouldn't end up in this horrible place. And Abraham said, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. And the rich man said, no, but if somebody comes back from the dead, then they'll take heed. And Abraham said, even if someone rises from the dead, they won't take heed if they don't hear Moses and the prophets. And you know, someone has risen from the dead, Jesus. And still many people don't believe. So if the ark was found, I doubt if many people would believe. I think it'd be cool for you and me, but I don't think a number of people would believe, unfortunately. Well, let's kind of sum it up from here. Noah at this time sent a raven out, and then later on he sent a dove out, waited a little while, the dove came back. He waited a few more days and sent the dove out again. Then the dove came back with an olive leaf, proof that the waters were subsiding and that things were starting to grow. Then he waited a little bit longer, and then finally God told him, go out of the ark. Verse 16 of chapter 8, go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. We jump down to verse 20. It says, after they went out of the ark, then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. I think it's interesting that the first thing Noah does when he comes off of the ark is he worships God. He builds an altar and he offers sacrifices to God. And then God promises him. We read on in verse 21, and the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Then the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. And we read in chapter 9, so God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, and on all that move on the earth, and on all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs. So here we find that man becomes a meat eater at this point. Apparently up until this time, they were vegetarians. Verse 4, but you shall not eat flesh with its life. That is, its blood. This was condemned back then. It was condemned under the law, and it was condemned in the New Testament, Acts chapter 15, that man was not to eat blood. Why? Because the life of the flesh is in the blood, and it's the blood that makes atonement for the soul upon the altar. Verse 5, surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I will require it, and from the hand of man. From the hand of every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. And so here we have the beginning of capital punishment. Here we have the authority of the governmental sword. And so this would be restated, codified under the law of Moses. And of course we see it as well in the New Testament. Romans chapter 13 in verse 4 says, speaking of the governmental authority, he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid. For he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. So we see as they come off the ark, they become meat eaters. They're not to eat blood, and also capital punishment is instituted at this time. Then we take it up from verse 8. It says, then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, and as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. Jump down to verse 13. I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And so it was God's promise that he would no longer wipe the earth out by a flood. Now, again, remember, up until this point, it probably had not rained, so there were not the water particles in the air to form the rainbow. So now as it would rain, the rainbow would be up there, and it would be a reminder that God would not wipe out the earth anymore by a flood. It's comforting. However, we look to the New Testament, and we find the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. The world will not be destroyed by a flood, but it will be destroyed one day by fire. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Again, remember, there's two roads that we could go down. We can either go God's way or we can go our own way. If we go our own way, it's going to end up in judgment, just like the people in Noah's day and just like the people that will stand before God one day at the great white throne judgment. We can go that way or we can go the way towards God, and we can have God's blessings in our life and God's promises that he will be there for us, that he will never leave us or forsake us. I trust that all of you have chosen the road that leads to God and the road that will lead to eternal life. And if you never have done that, then I'd encourage you to, at this time, on this day, ask Jesus to come into your heart and be your Lord and Savior, because he is the only way. He is the door. He is the way, the truth, and the life. And no one comes to the Father except through him. Amen.